Thank you for tuning in to this episode of Entangled With. Today we will be interviewing Dr. Almut Biger, head of the Theoretical Physics Research Group at the University of Leeds. Almut specialises in theoretical quantum photonics and has been behind some of the key advances in the field of quantum information processing using light. She studied for a PhD at the Institute of Theoretical Physics at the University of Göttingen before holding several postdoctoral positions at the Imperial College in London, the Max Planck Institute in Munich, and the University of Cambridge. So thank you so much for joining us today, Almut. It's a real pleasure to finally be able to speak to you about quantum technologies. So I guess we'll just jump straight in. And the first thing I wanted to talk about was, I suppose, when you started your academic career, the things were very different and compared to now, where it's very much a hot topic and people are very excited about it and investing lots of money. So I was just wondering, what is your perspective on how things have changed over these years?
I mean, I grew up in the 1980s in Germany when people just started to have a computer at home. So it was kind of and that was a huge change to have computers. Everyone was super excited about it. And when I started my PhD, I was working really on basic fundamental problems in quantum optics. I did my PhD in Göttingen. Segerfeld, who had a background in really theoretical physics, mathematical physics, quantum field theory. And we looked into more fundamental problems about what are measurements, how do you implement them, are they real? A lot of things you take completely for granted. And they have changed a lot because people just do measure. They measure quantum properties all the time now. And I had absolutely no idea about quantum computing or quantum technology. I kind of got into this more or less by chance. I mean, there was really no buzzword or anything about this. Quantum was just something that was puzzling that we tried to understand, but not something that you could use for anything really. I mean, there are transistors, of course, and atomic clocks kind of started being around at that time. But it was mainly something that was strange. Yeah. And I was lucky that Peter Knight from Imperial College, he was one of the first people. He got involved in this quantum computing community quite early on when it started taking off. And he was looking for people who knew more about these experiments that had previously only been used to test foundations of quantum physics. And then he approached me and said, do you want to come to London as a postdoc? I said, yeah, London sounds great. Let's go. I didn't really care what it was about. So at that time, I was still not interested so much in quantum technology, but that changed very quickly. Meeting people like Bennett, like Mike Nielsen, a lot of the people who really, Isaac Chuang. So that there were a lot of, it was good fun. And it was very exciting, yeah. Initially, people in London tried to prove that quantum computing would never work.
Wow.
They tried to find limitations for it, but that changed very quickly. And
were they
physicists, but for example, the idea was that if an atom is excited, it will emit a photon. So any information you try to store in an atom is immediately lost. Because every quantum system in the end, it's somehow open and then you have problems. So you lose your photon and your information is lost. You don't know when it happens. You can't fix it. So that was kind of a bit the initial skepticism. But of course, immediately when you realize that this is the problem, then you say, okay, I put my information in ground state. And there are quite a lot of clever techniques around to then avoid ever having a photon emission. It's some of these techniques we touched on in the lectures, like STIRAP, which is always a bit puzzling because in quantum mechanics, everything you do is essentially some kind of rotation of your state vector. But then you can do that in a way that it's very robust at the same time. It doesn't matter how you rotate it, you always end up in exactly the same state. There's a lot of engineering that's gone into it, but I think that by now it's, of course, it's a completely different field. When I go to conferences now, half of the people wear a suit and come from industry, and I've never seen them before, and they really put the big amounts of money into realizing quantum computers. And
I guess you look at, like, you know, like the setups for some of these things, like Google's quantum computer, you know, like cooling things down to millikelvin temperatures, like that must have seemed impossible 20 years ago, but now the engineering's here, isn't it? It is actually possible.
The cooling techniques are around more or less since 20 years probably. If you remember Ben Barco, he has been involved in designing these kind of cool fridges for maybe foundation type of experiments. So he was really working in Munich at the time, trying to prepare a state that had exactly like 3 photons in it, which was it's not an easy task. So you wanted to prepare that in a cavity, and they needed fridges for that. And so it's I think some of the developments have been extremely fast. Someone told me recently that developing the TV and making it the mass product took like 60 years to really kind of get it off the ground. And now everyone has a TV at home, or maybe not anymore because we watch it on the computers. And quantum technology has been quite fast in the beginning because a lot was already, there were a lot of ion trap experiments are out there since the 1980s. But it's kind of the a lot of the miniaturization, like that you can get the same kind of behavior in solid state system, that makes it much more feasible for IBM, for Google, for all the big guys to
I guess who knows where this, you know, maybe in another 6 years time, you know, like TVs, everyone will have some form of quantum chip in their computer. I think that's why I like, you know, photons, because it could potentially be possible with photons, right? Because you don't need those to cool them down to really low temperatures. I don't know. You can hope.
I mean, we need better photon sources, single photon sources, and more control. But that's where you guys come in.
That's where the PhD students need to step up. I mean, it's nice to hear that. I don't know, I think a lot of the people that we've interviewed, they have the same sort of story of how they start. They start with something quite abstract and theoretical for their thesis of masters or whatever, and then someone approaches them and says, hey, we've got this new quantum thing that we don't know anything about. Can you help us try and understand it? Mm. So of course that started with theoretical physics. You mentioned that was quite a that was a strong area for you, so of what you're an expert in. So what about now? Like, what are the current research problems you're looking at currently? Just as like a broad overview.
Mm. I mean, I come from a theoretical physics background, but we've always been very close. We've been always been talking to experimentalists, like people who build single photon sources, like Axel Kuhn in Oxford, or people who do ion trap experiments, and then thinking about what can we do that's useful for them. How can we would put out a proposal for quantum computing for some entangling scheme, and they would say, oh yes, nice. And then I would say, oh, why don't you build it? And they would say, oh, but we have this and this problems. And then you kind of try to invent the next generation. And we've always been looking a lot also in, so it's always been a way back and forth between looking into foundations and then looking at possible applications. I mean, one of the things we looked into was a two-atom double slit experiment. And I think we still haven't fully understood that kind of experiment, that you can have like two atoms and they spontaneously emit photons. Maybe you remember that we talked about it a bit in the lecture. And they're driven by lasers, but essentially they behave like in a double slit experiment, as if they are the slits in an experiment. And when you put a photographic plate and you collect the photons on a photographic plate, you get an interference pattern. So you actually see photons where you can't tell if they come from atom one or atom two. They really come from both atoms. And kind of understanding these kind of experiments better It's a very powerful tool of connecting atoms over a distance. You can use that to create entanglement. If you design things in the right way, you can entangle them in this way by just looking at the photons and play with those kind of experiments, but also fully understanding what is happening there. I think there's still a lot of open questions. So we have recently been looking a lot into what are photons, what is light. So that's kind of what excites us at the moment. So it's again back to the foundations, but hopefully we'll also have applications.
So is that a sort of like recurring theme that we start with this idea of, oh, this is a really we want to research into the foundations of this particular thing, and then we find some interesting effects, and then we see what we can do with them with applications. So for example, we could study entanglement and then come up with a key distribution protocol that achieves a practical use of that.
Yeah, you're kind of puzzled by certain things. We were puzzled a lot by how to model mirrors. Actually, we looked first at optical cavities. And in a lot of quantum optics lectures, what we do is we treat the cavity as something as like a trap for light, and it traps like a standing wave inside, and then it spontaneously emits photons. But when you look at it from a classical point of view, that doesn't make any sense at all. If you have two mirrors and you shine light on them and you are on resonance, all your light comes out on the other side. So if you make a model of a standing wave, you just don't know where your laser came from. You don't have enough parameters to put that in your system, and you just get nonsense. Experimentalists, they don't worry so much about it because they just use classical methods whenever the quantum models don't work. and often, even if they are incomplete, these models work quite well. You have a puzzle as a theorist. It's kind of, we try to be a bit perfectionist. We try to understand things, and we try to make a theory where everything fits nicely together. And when you then suddenly have something where you have a very simple classical effect, you shine light in from one side, it goes out on the other. Why can I not model this classically on a quantum level? If I put in the usual standard master equations, I just get complete nonsense. Because then light comes out on both sides randomly, and we don't know how can we build that in. So then you realize that the model is not complete. It can't be complete if I cannot tell my model where my excitation comes from. So we've been working on that, and then we managed to get a nice model that reproduced the classical behavior. And then one of my students said, so it works well with a cavity, but how about a single mirror? Now you have a Hamiltonian. You have light that comes in, that couples to light that goes out. But how about the light that goes out? Does it also couple back to the light that goes in? Because your Hamiltonian has to be emission. and then again, we suddenly had a nice, more complete model. But again, it was complete nonsense. It kind of something we knew classically. We can't reproduce it. And that definitely has to be the case. You have to be able to reproduce all the classical behavior, otherwise your quantum models are useless. And that's very disturbing. So we've been working in the last, we spent a bit of time now trying to fix this mirror problem. And what it comes down to is in principle, what you need is you need some, what we try to model when you model optical elements, what you want to model is, or even a beam splitter, it's a kind of nice local device. Something happens locally. You have some wave packet coming in, turns around and goes out, and some of it goes through. But when you work with photons in frequencies, they are kind of everywhere. They're completely spread out. And then you classically, you would never do that. When we write down Maxwell's equation, we always write them down as local equations. So we were trying to find a local description of light. And then we immediately had the problem that so the standard description is incomplete. So we found that there is a degree of freedom. There are degrees of freedom missing, which is a bit disturbing because we are using this theory for so long. But usually, so what we usually do is we assume that we have photons with positive frequencies, and then you can put them together, superpose them to get wave packets of any shape. But there is a problem when you build a wave packet that's very localized, and you evolve it in time with your standard formalism, it immediately spreads out, and you have your, even when you start with a local wave packet, it immediately spreads out and is everywhere. And that's not what you see in the linear. Daniel, when you prepare a single photon, it goes in one direction and it stays. Its shape does not work. Every bit of it moves with the speed of light. Yeah, so we had to play with it. And then so we doubled the degrees of freedom that we were considering. And eventually we built a new model for, built a Hamiltonian for a mirror. So it's like going back. It's like the more we look at it, the less we understand. You fix one problem and then you realize you can't even solve a simpler problem. And then it kind of goes backwards. But one of my students...
Almost makes you nervous. To,
it makes you very nervous.
Yeah.
It makes also everyone else very nervous. That's the referees of papers, they get very nervous of trying to understand. But there are a lot of linear optics experiments where they use ultra-short laser pulses, because if you want to do things fast, a photon that comes out of an atom is maybe a meter long. But if a photon comes out of an optical cavity and it's 60 meters long, then you have to wait a little bit until your photon has passed by, and then you can make the next one. So making photons very short, then you can do experiments much faster. So you kind of, there's also a need for a better description. So we added some negative frequency photons, and then we can build wave packets now that really stay together and move in one direction. So it's in the longer term, our hope is not just to make it more nicer. If every system has a Hamiltonian, a mirror also should have a Hamiltonian. That was the idea. And there shouldn't be only scattering operators for beam splitters. There needs to be a description that fits with everything else, how we describe everything else. But also when if we learn what other degrees of freedom there are, we might design new devices. That's the idea in the longer term. We can play with those degrees of freedom. And once you are aware of it, then you can see that there are many people who have been looking at exactly these kind of questions. So it's not completely out of this world. Or it's not that we overlook something very simple. More slowly. We don't have applications for that yet, but we're looking for them.
that's really interesting. Yeah, so what is the, I guess, what's the main distinction between like classical and like quantum light? Or is that one?
Light is really interesting because light is very simple. It's kind of, everyone knows what light is. But still, over the years, there have been so many different models, classical models, and now we have quantum models in addition. You really have to keep in mind when you talk about light that everything we do is just a model.
Yeah.
There is no classical light and no quantum light. Everything, if you want, everything is quantum, or everything is the same. But then depending on what experiments you're looking at, you can, if you ask a child, it probably says light, these are rays. because when you do experiments, when you play in the garden, you see shadows, and that fits very nicely together. It's only very recent that people talk about light as waves. It was really Huygens who made some really nice experiments. I watched a YouTube video recently where someone was interviewing people about what is light on the beach in Australia. And then they made a cardboard box and put little holes in it. And then people could look inside. So sunlight would come in and they would see the light. But instead of seeing two dots, they would see interference patterns. And that really, this kind of diffraction experiments, they tell you that light is really waves. But then at the same time, we also know light is also particles. And that was believed a long time in classical physics. So it really depends a lot on the context. And the trick is to find one model. And that's, I think, what quantum physics is trying to do, where you have one model that has all these different properties in one place and at the same time is simpler than everything what you had before. I mean, quantum physics never simple, but you get used to it, or at least you have a nice, elegant formalism that you can use to describe all kinds of experiments. But it's then the same formalism for, doesn't matter if you send your light through a big slit, a small slit, you just use one model.
So are there sort of like experiments that, so I suppose that this, so maybe you just answered my question, that something like the double slit experiment is something where you could like definitively tell whether light admits to the classical or quantum model. So this would be one such example that shows us that the classical model is incomplete.
Yeah, the double slit experiment, I mean, it just shows you that it's not a ray. A single slit experiment. I think you need to probably need two holes in your cardboard box to see the interference, and then you see more dots than just the two.
Because I suppose the wave, if you have a wave description of light and you have two slits, then you get the interference. It's only when you're actually looking at individual particles going through the slits and you get interference, and that's when you need to consider quantum.
Yeah, so when you go to this two-atom double slit experiment that they did in Vineland's group in Boulder, where you have the two atoms emitting photons, then you have, and you go to a very weak driving, so you have very little light arriving on that plate, then what you see is you see lots of dots arriving. So they're really individual particles coming out of these atoms, which are the photons. But then if you wait long enough, then you have dark stripes and very light stripes, dark stripes. So you really see an interference pattern at the same time, which means that every photon must have information about all the different directions, because somehow it knows where to click. So that overall you get this kind of strange interference pattern forming.
Is this where we hear like the strange, I don't know, you hear like the strange statement, like the photon interferes with itself, or like the probability waves interfere with each other and stuff like that? Is that sort of thing what you mean?
For a long time people I went to a summer school once and they were telling us over and over again, photons only interfere with themselves. and then someone did experiments where you have completely different sources, like one source was maybe a single atom, the other one was a parametric down conversion crystal or something. So you have photons from completely different sources. And they also interfere, which is very strange. But that's kind of, you have all these strange effects, but usually there is a simple underlying model in physics and that's what we're always looking for. So a simpler model that kind of covers more of those phenomena. And then you know you're on the right track. The fascinating thing about physics is that there are always these simpler underlying models. They're just sometimes really hard to find. It's like you can't see the trees in front of... I don't know exactly how... I forgot how the saying goes, but yeah, you get the...
So what are maybe some of like the key... So when we see the quantum... these quantum effects, like what are some of the reasons why this gives us advantages in terms of like information processing and stuff like that? Are there any key enablers that would give us this advantage over classically, over using just, I don't know, optical fibers with classical light and stuff like that?
I think it's more or less what you just said, is you can count single photons, so you can there are experiments you cannot do with light if you need a single photon detector. So you need something that mimics a single atom and says, I got a photon, makes a click or no click. So you kind of detect exactly a photon. And then depending on what sources you use, you can create photons that are linked together. So if you have a parametric down conversion crystal that creates photons in pairs of one polarization like that and one like that, but you don't know which one is sent in which direction, then you get entanglement. Yeah. And then you detect one photon on one side and you find it in one polarization, you know that automatically the one on the other side is the other. So then it seems like you have information traveling faster than the speed of light, or you can have correlations that you cannot have classically. And it doesn't even matter what polarization you have, very strong correlations. You cannot mimic, reproduce with the system of the, with a classical experiment. Mm. So entanglement, I think, is a big player, but also temporal correlations. If you measure a system, you can get very strong correlations. If you don't do complete projective measurements, but you filter out some information, and then you can get very nonlinear dynamics in there. So it's mainly, non-classical correlations. And entanglement is probably the best known form of it, or the most puzzling form of it. And this is kind of are exactly the features that we use for processing quantum information in a way that it becomes, that it scales better than it does in the classical world. Like in quantum cryptography, you use entangled photons, for example. You send one to Alice, one to Bob, and these photons are in these complicated states, so that if someone looks at it in the middle, Alice and Bob's correlation get disturbed, and then they know someone has been there and has been messing with them. But if nobody's messing with them, then they have these very pure correlations that they can use to exchange information, or they have shared information that they can then use. So even if, I guess, if you think about it from a classical point of view, people cannot share a secret without getting together and talking to each other and exchanging the secret. But with photons, you can send, if you have these entangled states, you can establish a secret over a distance, and there's no way of someone getting this information out, which is quite puzzling. Yeah. Mm. And then in quantum computing, it more or less gives us normally, if you have a computer that can only be 0 and 1, then you cannot take a shortcut from your initial information to your final information. But being allowed to have superpositions, having more degrees of freedom, you can take shortcuts and you can get to your answer more quickly. Yeah. I'm not sure. No. It's very hand waving, of course. It's not really.
That's really nice intuition, actually. As intuitively as entanglement can be said. It's interesting you mentioned when you talk about eavesdropping in quantum key distribution, that you sort of introduce these errors, and that you can sort of think of that, I suppose, as having a state and then having an environment in which we embed the state in. And then that environment will cause noise and basically destroy the purity of the state. So that leads us on nicely to our next sort of topic. Is this a key recurring problem within quantum systems, that we have an ideal state, for example, like an ideal qubit, and we'd like to treat it as an isolated system, but in reality, there's always some non-trivial interactions going on. This qubit's always embedded within its environment, and that will always cause some information loss to its environment.
Yes and no. we wrote in 2000, we wrote a paper at Imperial College when I was still there, that was called Quantum Computing Using Dissipation. So dissipation is more or less like a loss of energy and damping. But if you have a good understanding of what your system is doing, you can design your system in a way that the damping only occurs to your errors. So if you can make sure that when I was giving talks about it at the time, I sometimes compared it to bowling. If you do bowling, then having quantum mechanics is like you have to be very skilled because what you have is you have your unitary dynamics, which means you're playing on a very flat floor. And if you want to go from A to B, you have to throw your ball on the send it along the right trajectory. But if you do bowling on a plane that looks like this, yeah. So if you have if your bowling lane is very old and it's deeper in the middle than on the outside, you can be as drunk as you want to. You always hate a strike. Yeah. So if you build the dissipation and the damping into your system in the right way, then it can work to your advantage. For example, if you have two atoms and you send laser light on them, then you kind of rotate their states and you will change their states, but they will never become entangled. But if you put them in an environment where, for example, symmetric states get damped away and asymmetric states do not have any damping, then suddenly you put on your lasers and the only state that you can excite is your asymmetric state. And if that is an entangled state, then you made your computation, or you end up with having a much better computer than what you were that you would naively get. So some people say there is no free lunch, but I think there is very often. You can often optimize things. Yeah, so you can find solution that's good for everyone, and it just. We need to look for those kind of solutions. Yeah, so you can kind of steer around it. The disadvantage of these kind of tricks is that your computation becomes very slow. Yeah, so if you want to build in dissipation, you do need to do everything. You need to throw your ball in bowling very slow. and then other errors might come in. So you don't gain enough, but... But this way of thinking of essentially that's also what quantum error correction does, is you don't really weed out any information, but you make sure you have no errors. And luckily in quantum physics, we have this kind of quantum Zeno effect, which was what I was working on in my PhD. It's a very strange effect that when you measure a quantum system, then it cannot evolve. So if there is a state that you don't want to populate, then what you do is you measure it all the time. And if you measure it, then your system cannot go in there. So you block it. And in this way, you can find some ways of manipulating your system so that it does what you want it to do more easily. Yeah. So a bad thing is not always bad. But we need to understand it very well. In order to design things around it in a good way. Yeah. There are still a lot of things we don't really understand very well, which is a bit irritating, but also means we will have a lot of fun.
Definitely. So like when we were talking about this quantum Zeno effect, so we keep making repeated measurements on our system, like practically how does that look? Like, is that, do we have to make them really, really, really quickly and really close together in order to preserve, or is that a big challenge to implement?
It depends. In some system you have measurements going on all the time anyway. If you have an atom that's in an excited state, then and you have a possibility for it to emit photons, just seeing if photons are coming out or not is implementing measure. It's enough to implement a measurement. And so the atom behaves also already like a, there's already damping going on. So there are some natural measurements that you can use. So if you put your atoms in a cavity and look if the light is coming out or not, then that kind of restricts their dynamics already on subspaces that you might want. But you can also build in measurements. Some measurements is you apply a laser pulse, you pump your state and see if it produces photons. And if no photons come out, even when you expect them, then you know that state wasn't populated. Yeah. But also even just having strong interactions is enough to you don't even need to have photon emission. What people realize is just having strong pulses and disturbing a system that is dead, then it's not, it cannot participate in any other evolution, and you can kind of decouple it. And and then building in symmetries and playing things in the right way, then you can try to use it to your advantage. It doesn't always work, but at this point, so quantum information becomes a lot of engineering. Yeah. So at the end, we don't need everything to be a quantum computer. We just need to be able to build one. So as long as you find one system where you can do it, then. And I think there is at the moment there's quite a race going on. We are still not completely sure which system will be the one that is working. But I think the exciting thing is that in the 1990s, when I started working on quantum optics, the experiments were really ion trap experiments with optical cavity. These were really the workhorses for quantum optics experiments. And even ion traps is not an easy way of, it's not something like when Haroche in Paris, when he got the Nobel Prize for looking at atom field interactions in optical cavities. Some of those experiments, they took 20 years to set up and to perfect and to really see the quantum dynamics happening there, which was very exciting at the time. But now there are people like in engineering here in Leeds, for example, they dope atoms into glass, and those atoms behave like a trapped ion. Maybe it's not good enough yet for high precision experiments, but you can do sensing experiments. Or Daniel, you're going to work on single photon sources. They, I'm sure you are not having a vacuum chamber around it with, I don't know, 10 to the minus 18 something. some incredible low densities of atoms inside, which they needed to do in the. And I think that that's the exciting big bit, because there's a lot of technology out there for building photonic devices. Mm. And I think there will be a real expansions when the quantum computing, quantum technologies community starts working. Yeah, if you bring the quantum quantum technology into.
That's really interesting. So like when we're talking about like an optical quantum computer, like are there a few fundamental key building blocks that would go into putting this computer together? Like classically you would talk about logic gates, and you would put these together, and you stick, and then you basically just abstract a level up, and then you put those blocks together, and you go one more level and so on until you reach your classical computer. So what sort of building blocks are there for a photonic quantum computer that we need to consider?
Yeah, you need to have a very good source for single photons. You need to entangle those photons. So often people use photon and sources that already produce entangled photons. And then you more or less send them through a linear optics network. And the linear optics networks is a bit like playing Go. The rules are very simple. Essentially, you have just beam splitters and phase shifters that you put together. But also the rules are very simple. The outcomes of the game can be very complex. So to predict how likely it is if you send in a photon on one input port in a linear optics network, to predict where it comes out with all the interference that's going on inside, that's already a computational hard problem that a classical computer cannot solve very well.
That's a nice analogy. I've not heard that one before.
These probabilities where the photon comes out, they depend not on determinants but on permanence of matrices, and they are hard, they are computationally hard to get. But it depends on what kind of design you are going for. So you can measure photons, you encode information in them, and then you design your gates and put them together to an algorithm. The problem at the moment is that we cannot entangle photons on demand. But that's one of the things we're hoping for by if we can utilize these extra degrees of freedoms, then hopefully we can for photons, and hopefully we can entangle them much more easily.
So by on demand, do you mean like we can try and then there's a probability that we fail each time?
Yeah, so at the moment you can have a probability of 1/2 that you entangle two photons.
Right.
If you do a Bell measurement, for example, if you measure or you have... Yeah, even if you have entangled photons as a resource, if you want to do a gate operation that could entangle the two photons, but you don't know what their state is, so it's a lot of things that have to come together. But I think if we can turn that into deterministic operations, then it becomes really interesting. And hopefully there is more space for improvement still.
Yeah, I think a lot of research is focusing on that. So, you know, how to make it more deterministic through things like multiplexing. And
Yeah. There is photons that collect phases, or in classical optics, you have a lot of topological phenomena that people play with. You have lots of phases that are very robust that light can accumulate. But on the photon level, we're still a bit lost on how to put all of this together. Yeah, I'm not sure if we will find better solutions, but as we said at the moment, maybe trying to close this little gaps of how you model a mirror with a Hamiltonian as a first step, and then so we're currently trying to find 3D descriptions for light, and then hopefully we can also look at light traveling in more complex structures, but it will take time. But even these ideas with multiplexing, they're very puzzling. They puzzled a lot of people. Suddenly you could do things that didn't seem possible before. There's always whenever someone tries to go and formulate a no-go theorem, usually they write down exactly the conditions that you need to break to get around it. And then once you know what those conditions are, then you can play with it. And yeah. I don't think we will run out of work to do there.
That's good. You'll always have a job then.
Yeah. You guys especially, you guys.
Yeah, and us as well, hopefully.
Yeah.
Once we graduate.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess a lot of people think, you know, quantum computing is just like a more powerful version of classical computing. How would you explain the advantage that, you know, quantum computing has over classical?
Yeah, there are different ways of explaining it. I usually, my daughter gets very annoyed when I tell her that classical computers are very stupid. They're very good at things that the humans, for example, are very bad at. They can add numbers very, very well. And when she was in primary school, I mean, they tortured her by multiplying. She really had to remember how to multiply to numbers, and you go through the same thing over and over again. And for a computer, that's very straightforward. So it's a computer can do things very, very well. It doesn't mind repeating the same steps over and over again. But if you ask even simple questions like, oh, the guy who was knocking on my door, who was it? then pattern recognition is very hard. While a human, when they look at someone, they know immediately who it is, even if the guy is not wearing exactly the same clothes or has grown a beard in the meantime, you still recognize people. And so there is a, for me, if you want to say what a quantum computer does, it makes computers, maybe it won't turn them into humans, but it will expand their capabilities a lot more towards what humans are good at. And that might turn out to be very, very useful. But it's like with every technology, you can use it to your advantage, or it can make life more complicated than it is already. Yeah.
Or I guess it can be abused even.
Yeah. I think that the more in the more immediate future, so building real quantum computers that have more interesting algorithms, We had Jonathan Dowling gave us a talk once, and he was telling us that when secret services in the US, if they want to know what the future looks like, what they do is they invite science fiction writers and physicists. They put them together in a room and let them talk. And of course, as physicists, it's always difficult to imagine what you could really do, what algorithms you could do with a quantum computer. But science fiction writers, they're more asking the questions, what would people like to have? And once you ask that question, then scientists, they will sooner or later come up with solutions that kind of connect the dots. I think at the moment there is a lot of interesting things are happening in terms of sensors, and that will change our life a lot. I mean, many of us already have these kind of sports watches that tell you what your blood pressure is and how well you slept, and then you can adjust your life and maybe say, okay, I don't have a cup of coffee at night, maybe I sleep a bit longer, or maybe drinking alcohol is only good in small amounts, or you kind of see immediate effect. A student of mine, he set up a company for glucose sensing. But if you had a proper glucose sensor in your watch, that would be a great, of course, for people who have diabetes. But also it will affect our behavior a lot, how we eat, how we... So in principle, at the moment, telephones have become very smart. Computers have become very smart. But all other devices are still far away from being smart. And it's very hard to imagine what that will mean when, yeah. Or if you think of if you have good sensors, if you have a reliable quantum computer that really drives your car better than you ever can. Yeah, if it really lowers the risk by a factor 10 or by a factor 100 that you have an accident, then most people would be happy to let the computer drive. But also if you have these safe, if a computer drives your car and it's very safe, you don't need to make your car weigh a ton. You can can almost sit in a car box and drive anywhere you like. So you will save a lot of energy. You might not want to have a car as a status symbol. It might be something you pick up and leave. So there's a lot of everyday life things that changes technology, not necessarily quantum, but as technology progresses.
Interesting. How does the glucose sensing work then?
Yeah, we're still patenting it.
Oh, okay. You can't talk about it, that.
It's an optical sensor. So you at the moment you have to draw blood or stick something in your skin. So the idea is to do something that's non-invasive.
Yeah.
But there's a big race going on at the moment. I'm reading a runner's magazine, and they recently had an article about quite a lot of devices. Apple just filed a patent also for. So there is a lot of stuff going on, but it's not always clear if these are already very good solutions or.
I think sensing is quite exciting, and you know we're seeing applications now. I think I heard there's a startup that are building this drone that can fly above, mm-hmm. say, for example, a power plant, and it can detect like the amount of the various quantity of gases it's emitting. Now mm-hmm. that's coming like a technology they're going to sell in the next like year or two.
Mm-hmm. So if you can detect. If you can detect environmental pollution much more easily, then you can reduce crime. If you can detect drugs, all kinds of, but also in terms of health, it would have a lot of positive effect. I'm sure a lot of people can also think about a lot of negative, but.
Interesting. Yeah. So, yeah, I guess, did you hear, I guess you must have heard about Jianwei Pan's group and their recent demonstration of quantum advantage. So how impactful do you think their work was on the advancement of quantum computing using photonic platforms?
I don't know I didn't look at the details of the experiment.
They use Gaussian boson sampling.
Yeah.
Essentially, I guess, you know, they create a problem that's sort of too hard for the classical computer to do in like a reasonable amount of time. But I guess the thing is, I suppose, you know, it's not useful yet, but I suppose, you know, it could be made useful in the future.
Yeah. Yeah, there is a big race happening at the moment of who can really prove that there is a quantum supremacy. It's not an ideal word, but that quantum computers really can do things. I guess most people who work in the community, they are already convinced that quantum is an advantage and it's real. But I think in terms of getting people outside the immediate quantum physics community to understand and see there is something you cannot do classically, you need breakthrough in experiments like that. You need someone like Jan Weipan.
To encourage more people to, you know, provide investment and to back.
And to take this serious, what is happening.
Yeah, a lot of convincing. Yeah.
That's a big convincer.
Yeah.
I mean, in principle, we have quantum technology already for a while. If you think the atomic clocks, they're around since maybe late 1980s. And their precision is due to quantum effects. And without that, we would not have GPS. But using quantum in a more direct way and really showing explicitly how powerful it can be, it's very exciting. Yeah. There have been a few claims over the last years, and
it's really exciting. And maybe you could tell us, like, because of course you've had quite a range of experience out of all the various projects you've worked on and stuff. Is there anything that particularly stands out for you as something that you're quite proud of, or you think has gone a long way or a lot further than you would have initially thought?
It's hard to say. I mean, it's like the projects you work on at the moment are always the most exciting.
Because they've often come from what you've already done before.
Not only that, it's kind of what we are just absorbed in at the moment and what we're looking at on an everyday basis. But we did some work some years ago on repeat until success quantum computing. It was together with a student, PhD student, who is now in Singapore and Quek, who's also, you might have come across his name in Singapore. So we showed that you can do deterministic quantum gates between atoms that are far away just by looking at the photons that are coming out of them. And that was a big surprise for a lot of people, because up to then it was the maximum success rate you could have with entangling two distant atoms was 1/2. And then we pushed it up to 1. And then, of course, you can entangle, if it works, you can entangle many atoms. You can build highly entangled states and put them together. So that was nice. And personally, I find it quite exciting that these ideas, or very similar ideas, are implemented now. I mean, in Oxford, in David Lucas' group, or Chris Monroe with his ion trap quantum computing, where they use these photons it's nice, yeah. it's very exciting. Or the Delft experiment of testing Bell's inequality. I mean, what surprises me always is how quick things change. When we organized the conference in 2015, we organized a big European conference in Leeds on quantum computing. And as a chair, I tried to get companies to come, and we thought we would be overrun with lots of people trying to exhibit something and to participate from industry, but there was no one. There was no one, and now you go to conferences and there are so many companies involved, and often you probably don't even know anymore what's going on, because a lot of research is probably going on behind closed doors. There is a LinkedIn now for One Quantum, for people who work on quantum technology, where you have a lot of startup companies exchanging ideas, lobbying politicians, and working also as a new industry together. And that was even 10 years ago, that was a dream, or less than 10 years ago. It was not imaginable to have something like that. So how quick things change is really amazing. Yeah.
Yeah, no, that is really exciting.
But what got you guys interested in going into quantum and doing a master's in quantum technology?
Yeah, it's a good question. I guess it's I don't know. I it's sort of a snowball effect, really, isn't it? You might get introduced to something somewhere just as an offhand comment. Oh, by the way, this might be due to quantum or something like that. And then you go and look at it yourself and you think, oh, well, this is actually really interesting. And you go down a few rabbit holes and it kind of just snowballs until you find it. You find everything else not as exciting in comparison.
Mm. Yeah, I guess it's a nice adventure. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Mm.
I mean, in the 90s, there were a lot of startup companies with the Silicon Valley and so on, and Bill Gates started out in his garage, and this quantum technology has a little bit of a feeling like that to it. I had a student of mine who founded a company. He's sitting at the moment. He's where his parents are, so he's really starting out in their garage. Of course, it's much harder to build. You can't build a quantum device but you can, if you have an idea and design it, and you can work with companies who can then help to build prototypes. Yeah, or you can work with experimental group who can actually build the sensors and test them. And so it's still this kind of pioneering feeling.
Yeah, I think that is probably what got me interested. You know, just the idea of, you know, is it possible to actually make this, you know, is it possible to physically make something like this that I suppose, you know, seems quite unnatural in a way on the face of it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, hopefully it works out.
Yeah. So, I mean, maybe following on from that, what advice would you perhaps give to someone who was wanting to pursue quantum as a career?
I don't know. I guess you always have to be true to yourself. Some people are more scientists. They try to understand everything very well. They have to work everything out. They have to. They really get disturbed if things don't add up. And then it's good to do a more scientific career. I mean, mainly you have to do something that you enjoy, is fun. And if you want an adventure and learn new things, then it's good to work maybe more in a smaller company, in a startup company, or contribute to research. And if someone who likes to read a lot and see a lot of things happening, for them it might be good to maybe become a patent attorney and work on. There are so many different ways. You just have to find your niche, and like in every industry, there are many, many different niches. And you should not do it in order to. Of course, everyone hopes that it works. But if you do something you like, then it's much easier to get through the difficult times where things don't work. And if you work with people you like, you get on well with. That helps a lot. You don't always get something in return immediately, and then you can be in for the long time, and in the long term a lot of very exciting things will happen, I guess.
That's a good advice, I think, definitely. Yeah, it's like, you just look at our cohort. We got, you know, no one's just done one particular thing. You know, people have, you know, got all sorts of, you know, you've come from an electronic engineering background, haven't you, Lewis? And then got someone else come from computing, you know. So it's an inclusive field.
yeah. And also in quantum information, I think what is nice about it is nobody is just doing quantum information. There's usually it's always combined with math, with engineering, with electronics, it's very multidisciplinary.
Yeah, definitely. And I guess that's why it pursues so quickly as well, because you have so many people approaching a problem from a different angle, and everyone can kind of build off each other.
Yeah, it's also it's an area of physics that's involved where experiment and theory are very close together. It's not that you have you don't have a dead end because like in some particle physics or superconducting physics, people might develop very complicated theories, but you can't test them. Or if you work on quantum gravity, theories might get very advanced before they can be tested, and then it's difficult to change that direction. If quantum optics, the experiments, they always immediately give feedbacks, and theorists talk a lot to experimentalists. And you can say a new theory is useful or it is not useful. It has been the understanding, I think, of how we describe things has changed very quickly over the last 20 years.
And maybe it's there's because been a lot of progress. More, I suppose, yeah, integration between theoretical and experimental.
Yeah. And also because of being so close to the application, if someone comes with a new idea, no one will say, oh, I don't like that because that's not how I would do it. It's kind of, okay, we can build it, so let's do it. Let's try it out. So new ideas get established much more easily maybe than in some other fields. Or maybe I'm too negative about it, but it has a nice dynamics. And also the experiment, they give results quite quickly. Yeah, so you can, within your PhD, it's not like you build a little device that's then part, it might in 10 years be part of another experiment. You do the whole thing. Yeah, you design it, you test it, you model it. So you have also quite a variety of skills involved, which makes it fun.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
And what would you say you're sort of most excited about in the future of this field, quantum technologies?
I don't know.
Maybe. There's patents that you can't discuss.
No. I think it's I don't know. It would be nice to see it's very hard to say. I mean, I, when I was 14, I was my father bought a computer, and it was amazing to program it, to play it, to make games with it. I'm not sure where this is going.
I suppose that is the exciting thing about it, really, isn't it?
Yeah.
You don't know what's going to come next.
Mm.
Yeah.
But technology has a lot of advantages. It has advantages and disadvantages, but hopefully it helps to make society more fairer. Maybe helps us to solve environmental challenges. Even now this lockdown. It would have been 20 years ago, being locked up at home would have been a nightmare, but now you still could talk to everyone online. Yeah, or I'm talking to you guys in Bristol right now from Leeds. Of course, computers, they destroy maybe a lot of personal relationship, but they also allow things to happen that would not have happened otherwise. So I'm not sure what quantum computing, quantum technology, what it will enable, but there are so many things where they can really make a huge difference in a positive way, hopefully.
Yeah, I think that's the aim, isn't it?
Yeah, that's the aim. But then, we're scientists as well, so we're not the ones. You need to talk to the science fiction writers, I think, at this point.
Yeah. And they will see what they're most excited for.
Yeah. I'm reading books sometimes from like Neal Stephenson, who's trying to predict what life will be like in 20 years' time. And there's, of course, because of technology, there are also huge dangers that society will split up more and more, and some people will not have we will be so overwhelmed with information, not everyone can afford to filter information to actually see what is real, what is not real, what is really happening. There's so much, it opens doors for manipulation. More of people, there are a lot of dangers, but at the same time, it also can enable interactions. If I can choose who I talk to, and it doesn't need to be just my neighbor in the street, if we can keep in touch with friends who live on the other end of the world, all this, that makes our life, enriches our life also a lot. Yeah. So it's,
I guess, you don't have control over what people use your inventions for, do you? But, you know, I mean, if you didn't invent it in the first place, then maybe they would, you know, you wouldn't have all the positive things that came from it.
Yeah.
So.
And also, it's, even if you don't go to a good school, you have access to a lot of information to learn. There's a lot of good things that we can use the internet already for. Yeah. Or some students who are bored, they don't have to listen to only the lectures that we offer. They can watch a lecture online from MIT. They can study things in much more detail. So I think it polarizes society maybe more. But it creates a lot of. It will also create a lot of opportunities. Even having more access to controlling health for everyone because of making medical devices cheaper and more easily available. This alone is worth going on the journey. Yeah. Or Luis, you're going to work on quantum cryptography. If you have secure communication, it's such a big. Big privacy issue.
It's sort of embarrassing that it's not been really solved.
progress is happening, and keeping your bank account more safe is something that is important.
Definitely.
But I don't know, I'm not good at, I'm not the right person to talk to. I'm not the one who can predict the future.
No, but that's why it's really interesting to get the opinion of someone who's really, really hands-on with the research. From that sort of perspective, it's really interesting to get your thoughts on these. So, no, thank you very much. That's really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's all the questions we had for you. Yeah. Thank you very much for speaking with us. It's been really, really interesting and really, quite insightful.
It has been good fun. Yeah, thanks for talking to me. And also, it's really exciting to see that you guys have gone on a similar journey.
Thank you for tuning into this episode of Entangled With. We hope you'll tune into future episodes with topics ranging from Google's quantum supremacy experiment to starting a quantum startup. Thank you and see you next time.